This is the current federal tax developments for the week of August the 7th, 2017, brought to you by the LoScalzo Institute and your State Society of CPAs. This week's been kind of a quiet week, but we are going to take a look at some developments we've had in the week. Colorado put out their tattletale use tax rules, and we've talked about that, you know, that law in Colorado, the 10th Circuit supported the law. We'll talk about how some of the rules now as it starts coming into effect. The IRS issues a warning on phishing emails. But their advice on how to avoid problems arguably makes users more likely to fall for these emails. We'll talk about a taxpayer that accidentally created a structure that killed the S corporation as soon as he stopped living. So we have that little detail to worry with. And the IRS gives us some details on how we compute our payroll tax deposits if you are a small business that's allowed to elect to apply your research credits against payroll taxes, and you've made that election. This is the time of year when, again, we have the summer's winding down, so we're beginning to see a little bit fewer courses being offered. I, this week, still have three courses here in Phoenix, so I'll be doing some work this week, finishing up my third straight week on the road doing courses. My fourth straight week doing courses. Been a while, been running. We have some coming up, though, in addition. Don Cochran will be doing a pair of courses in Washington, in the Bellevue, Washington offices of the Washington Society, on August the 24th on estate and gift taxation, and on the 25th for the multi-state taxation to business, which we'll talk to some extent about the Colorado law and having to work with that. I'm going to be doing some days at the end of September in Cincinnati. In Fairfield, Ohio, at the 27th, Fairfield just outside of Cincinnati. I'll be doing an alternate minimum tax course for 4 hours in the morning and a course on passive activities and IRS challenges in the afternoon. On the 28th of September, I will be doing in Ohio the multi-state taxation of businesses course. And again, we'll be talking about that particular Colorado law and something probably the people in Washington won't need to worry about, but those of you in Ohio might, if you have a client selling all across the country. Washington's new law. This is a tattletale law, very similar to Colorado, but at a much lower level. Again, for these courses, check the State Society websites and check all the State Society websites for the courses coming up at the various locations. Now let's get into our developments for the week. As I mentioned, one of the key developments we had that occurred was Colorado's publication of the rule that will be used to handle their tattletale use tax provision. This is Colorado Rule 39-21-112, parentheses 3.5. It was actually officially published on the 26th of July, but it's been posted now to their website. We have it at various locations now where we can take a look at it. For those of you who don't remember how this works, we had a case which was the Direct Marketing Association versus Broll, which actually came through last year, where the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals ruled that Colorado could require a company selling into the state of Colorado who had no connections with Colorado and did not have to collect Colorado sales or use tax because they didn't have sufficient nexus, could still nevertheless be required to give notice to Colorado customers that they owe use tax, to also be required to submit a report to those customers at the end of each year telling the customers about how much they had bought and remind them, oh, by the way, guys, you owe use tax. And finally, to submit that same list of what everybody had bought to the state of Colorado so they could follow up and make sure that the people had actually paid the use tax. The 10th Circuit in the direct marketing case had ruled that that did not violate any of the constitutional prohibitions. It did not implicate the Quill case because you weren't asking anybody to collect the tax. You were merely saying they had to provide notification. Well, that's all well and good, and everything was kind of on hold in Colorado until this got finalized. Well, it got finalized, so Colorado effectively started requiring you outside companies to comply with this rule as of July 1st. Now, one piece of good news, you don't need to do this unless you sell at least $100,000 worth of product into Colorado in a calendar year. Of course, the problem is you may or may not know if that's going to be triggered in a year, depending on how close you get. Obviously, if your company doesn't sell $100,000 a year, well, then you're probably in pretty good shape. But if you do have, you know, things like a web presence, and especially companies that sell things on the internet and are shipping products all around the country, then suddenly this whole thing becomes a bigger problem. Oh yeah, and by the way, if you're doing that by using something like Amazon Marketplace, or you're using something like eBay, well, Colorado says that still applies to you anyway. So you still have to make sure that you're actually reporting and telling people that they have to owe their Colorado tax, even if you do all your sales via eBay, if you are actually triggering the $100,000 limitation. Good idea. Now, the basic rule says every non-collecting retail, that means if you're not collecting sales tax, oh yeah, by the way, that obviously is one of the ways out. You don't need to worry about this law if you'll just go ahead and collect the use tax for the state of Colorado and, you know, collect the sales tax or use tax on your own and just send Colorado the money. As you may figure out rather quickly, compared to turning in customers and giving all the information we're going to need to give, collecting the tax probably is the simplest approach. And is that intentional? Well, yeah, but so you're voluntarily collecting the tax, so Quill isn't triggered. But the alternative is so bad that arguably you don't have a whole lot of choice. So every time you do this, you have to first provide a transactional notice to all potential Colorado purchasers. So when they go to your website or they get their catalog, they're warned that if they buy products from you, you're not going to collect Colorado sales tax and they owe Colorado use tax. So you must give that notice. If anybody goes ahead and buys from you after you told them you're going to turn them into the state, then you have to keep track of what they buy from you. And at the end of the year, send an annual purchase summary to those purchasers. We'll talk about there are some limitations, some cases where you get out of having to do it. But generally, you have to send a notice to them at the end of every year. And then you have to send a duplicate set of information, a similar information that's more summarized, to the state of Colorado, listing all the customers that bought from you that live in Colorado that, oh, by the way, should probably be paying use tax to the state of Colorado. Okay, the basic structure. Now, this transactional notice has to be provided, as I said, like online, when people are buying, it's got to be prominent, and it has to be near somewhere where you have a sales tax line or tax line where you indicate you're not going to collect any Colorado residents. You have to tell people you do not collect Colorado sales or use tax, that the purchase is not exempt from sales or use tax merely because you're making it over the internet or by mail, other remote means, and Colorado is going to require them to file a sales or use tax return. That's going to be the basic background they have. Now, one nice thing they do, because by the way, if all the states adopt this, as you can imagine, your webpage will have nothing but notices for every state. Colorado does state that if other states have similar requirements, that you can use a summary notice that will basically have the generalized information that, you know, you're going to owe it to whatever state there is. And then still, though, do the sub-reporting to Colorado based on Colorado purchasers. So you'll still have to run those notices out. Now, again, at the end of the year, by January 31st, at the end of the year, so by January 31st of 2018, for the 17 purchases after July 1st, you have to send them a summary summarizing your Colorado's purchaser's transaction in the previous year. The envelope has to be promptly marked, important tax documents enclosed, and sent to the last known address. They can opt in to receiving it electronically, but it's got to be an opt-in. You can't say you're just going to send them electronically. The purchase summary is going to have the total amount paid by them during the year. You include shipping and handling charges in that total unless you're certain the amounts are not subject to Colorado's taxes. A statement that Colorado requires them to file, but we're going to notify them a number of times of that little detail. And a notice that, oh, by the way, I turned you in. And if available, the dates of each purchase, the amount of each purchase, and description of the item purchased. And if you know whether or not each of those purchases was subject to Colorado sales or use tax. Now, one piece of good news, if the amount of purchases are less than $500 for that particular purchaser, you don't need to include them with the notices you send out. Finally, you got to send the state of Colorado an information return, right? In this case, if you have to send any notices to any Colorado customers, you have to do the summary back to the state of Colorado. You have to give the name of each purchaser, the billing address, the notice address you gave them to, and the shipping address of the purchaser. If there's more than one of those addresses, then you tell them about them all, right? And the total dollar amount of purchases made by the purchaser. And as you may expect, there are a number of penalties. If you fail to give the transaction notice, that's the pre-sale notice, it's $5 for every sale. The maximum penalty, if you're not aware of the requirement, you begin to provide notices in 6 days demand, the maximum penalty is capped at $25,000. Notice I didn't say you got out of the penalty. I just said it's maximum. You can ask for a waiver for reasonable cause. The penalty for failing to provide the annual summary to the purchasers is $10 for each summary you didn't issue. The penalty is capped at $50,000 if you weren't aware of the requirement and you send them out within 60 days of Colorado saying, hey guys, where are the notices? And if the notice they're providing within 30 days of the original due date, the penalty is capped at $1,000. And again, the department may waive some or all the penalty for reasonable cause. Finally, the penalty for failing to file the information return with Colorado telling them about who bought from you is $10 times the number of customers you're required to report. The same $1,000 cap applies if you're no more than 30 days late. And if you have no knowledge, again, the $50,000 limit, if you had no knowledge of the requirement, you respond within 60 days, you get the $50,000. Again, so if you sell into Colorado in a significant number, you're selling in a lot of states, you probably want to start paying attention to Colorado's tattletale rule. And oh, by the way, start watching for a bunch of other states' tattletale rules, because we expect we're going to see a bunch of these over time. Right, all of it comes up and ends up running in this way. Let's go on to our next standpoint this time. The IRS has issued a new warning about phishing emails. So we're going to have phishing email warning coming up, the scam aimed at tax professionals. This is a Security Summit alert issued on August the 4th of 2017. What's happening this time is there is an email making the rounds right now that appears to come from your software provider. So it could be Intuit, Lacerte/Intuit. It could be from ProSystemFX, CCH. It could be from Thomson Reuters and UltraTax. Could be from Drake. Could be from whoever your provider is. It tells you that there is a software support upgrade, talks about an important software system upgrade. It thanks you for continuing to trust your software provider because we keep everything, secure. And because of that, though, we need you to revalidate your login because, of course, we want to be secure. Now, first thing to realize about this email, it's going to look exactly like your normal provider emails. I know what a CCH email should look like because we use ProSystemFX. Their email, if they're going to ape CCH, is going to look just like a CCH email. It's going to have the same graphics in there because that's not tough to do. It's going to be laid out identically. It's going to look just like a legitimate CCH email. If they're not very good, they'll have a from address that maybe is kind of like CCH, but not really. If they have any competence at all, though, they'll easily forge the from address so it appears to come from CCH. That's not difficult to do. If you understand how email works and you have access so that you can directly inject into the SMTP stream, which these guys should have in most cases, then it's just not that difficult to fake the from address. The IRS then, tells us that at that point you would give them the information. Instead of upgrading any software, they basically are going to now be able to log into your account at your vendor, access any client information that might be available via that mechanism, and potentially do other types of mischief. Change things like mailing addresses, which could mean the next software update comes to them, not to you. And by the way, then, hey, they then install the software, they can restore things. So they could set up shop as you fairly easily once they've gotten that information. Now, one problem we have with this is the advice the IRS is giving to people in this area. Part of it makes some sense. So let's talk about that. This scam, first thing they're going to say, which is very important to understand, your software companies are not going to embed links into emails asking you to validate your passwords and credentials. Well, we shouldn't say it. Now, the IRS says they won't, which means they've told the software companies not to do it. We have to assume there's not a software company stupid enough to not realize this would be a really dumb thing to do. So clearly that's highly suspicious. Unfortunately, they go on and say that, oh yes, you should never open a link or an attachment from a suspicious email. That's a problem. Why? No, I don't think you should take, if you have an obviously suspicious email that you think's fake, no, you don't go click the links. Fine. But unfortunately, I think a lot of users will read that line and say, oh, well, I wouldn't fall for this had I, you know, because it was, because I would notice a suspicious email. And this email that's trying to get my credentials that is, appears to come from CCH, well, it's going to obviously be suspicious. No, it won't. And unfortunately, too many users read that as saying, I can stop this whole thing by, as long as the email doesn't look suspicious, I can click it. This is unfortunately the risk of using boilerplate. And the problem is, this is advice that has been around for ages. And a number of years ago, you know, before the people became aware of this type of phishing operation or various items, yeah, this is probably good advice, because the, you know, the scammers back then didn't even try to hide anything. You know, comes with lousy, obviously English is not their first or third or fourth or fifth language in many cases. You know, it clearly didn't look like the regular emails. You know, it had all kinds of things that just, you know, made it look weird. But in the early years, people would still click on that. So we tried to teach people, well, don't click on suspicious emails. Or don't look at their attachments. You know, it's dangerous to do either. The problem is now, because that's been ingrained in users' minds, a lot of users will flip that. That does not say non-suspicious emails are safe, but that's the way most users are going to read it. I would be very leery of telling your staff that line about don't open suspicious emails. Tell them, you know, if you have any reason to doubt an email, you don't touch these things. But number two, your reasons to doubt will include the fact, you know, it has to go beyond just merely, oh, it doesn't look like a CCH email, or it doesn't look like a LACERT or an IRS or a AICPA or State Society of CPAs email. You have to treat all of those as potentially any email. And I hate to say it, because people are going to say that's not workable, but from a practical matter, every email with a link is potentially a problem. Now, you know, you're going to say, well, I can't work that way. Well, that sounds great, right? Till you get bit the first time. And then suddenly you discover that having clicked the link and having opened yourself up to an attack, suddenly you're going to have major liabilities and major problems. So be highly suspicious of any email that asks you to click. The safest thing to do always is to open your browser, type in the address manually, and go to the website and pay attention where they're sending you when you type in the address. If it's just a graphical link, always be suspicious. By the way, if it's a graphical link, it's not even really safe. You may know about hovering. Hovering over it to get an address, well, that works, but not really. Why? It's not that difficult using JavaScript to create a button that would put up a false little, you know, little bubble there or little line, wherever it's going to be in your mail program, your browser, whatever. It's not that difficult to have JavaScript put a fake up. It can be done. You can key that in. The only real way to figure out if they're doing something would be to study the source code, which I doubt anybody wants to do. So you just always have to be very, very careful. These scams are getting better and more sophisticated because people are getting aware. So just be careful. And as I say, the number one takeaway from this, just because an email doesn't look suspicious doesn't mean it's not a problem. Key issue. Now let's talk about a taxpayer who, S corporations aren't the best for dealing with complex structures. And the problem is, once you make your issues complex at all, you tend to run into a risk of blowing it up, because various things will blow up your S status and make it a C. Well, this taxpayer, unfortunately, went for a more complex status that appeared to work. but it turns out it only worked as long as he didn't die. The shareholder owned 100% of the S Corporation. This is private letter ruling 2017-30-002, issued on July the 28th. The shareholder takes all of his shares, puts them into a single member LLC he establishes. That's not a problem. Single member LLCs are disregarded, you know, unless he makes an election to make it a corporation. And then I suppose we could do a Q sub, but that seemed kind of weird. Why we do a Q sub in that structure, you know, rather than just keep it as a single member LLC. But so we're holding the shares in a single member LLC. That is no problem. Because disregarded, we look to who's holding the shares. It's an individual. Therefore, the individual is considered to own the underlying interest, and you know, we're fine. Okay, let's make it a little more complicated, going one more step. The taxpayer establishes a revocable living trust, and he transfers not all, but some of the interest in the single member LLC. Maybe he wanted to have the trust, you know, the shares in the trust would go to kid A, the shares that were outside the trust, he would have them go through his estate to kid B. Have no idea why we end up with a split, but we end up with a split. So part are in a single member LLC and part are, well, they're all in a single member LLC. Some of that interest is held by the taxpayer and some of the interest is held by the trust. Now you might think, well, now we got a problem, right? Because we have two owners. And if you have two owners, that make the LLC a partnership. And partnerships cannot own S-Corp stock. Correct on the idea that a partnership cannot own S-Corp stock. However, not correct that this structure is a partnership. Why not? We have to go through disregarded again. A 100% grantor-owned grantor trust, like their standard revocable living trust, is totally disregarded. So the LLC interest held by the grantor trust is deemed to be held by the grantor, who is this individual. So this individual is deemed to hold, let's say, the 30% that's in the trust. He's also deemed to hold, he holds the 70% not in the trust. So now we've reassembled, he owns 100% of the LLC. Since it's now an LLC with one owner for tax purposes, because we're ignoring the trust, it means that it's a disregarded entity. So now all the shares of the S Corp are treated as held directly by him. Perfect. And I'm sure, you know, people talked about that. He said, could I do it? They said, oh, you know, you studied it. You say, well, yeah. There's no problem with that. It all works. And by the way, it all works right up until he dies. As soon as he dies, I mean, this is one of those things instantaneously. You know, when they pronounce time of death, that wasn't just time of death of the shareholder. That was time of death of the S Corp. Because as soon as he dies, the trust goes from being a grantor trust that is disregarded to a very real non-grantor trust that now suddenly is a second shareholder. Because now the LLC's interests are held by a portion held by the estate of the deceased shareholder and a portion held by a trust that was established by the death of the deceased shareholder. Now note, both an estate and an estate is an eligible S shareholder, and a trust established based on your death, a previous revocable living trust, is eligible for 2 years. That's all great, but there's still two different shareholders. That means the actual shareholder now is a partnership. A partnership cannot own S shares, so immediately the S status is terminated. Well, that wasn't really the intent, obviously. You know, that wasn't the point. You know, if you wanted to have the S election die when you died, there were other things you could do to make that a lot easier. So turns out everybody agreed that wasn't our point. We didn't want that. So the S Corporation had to arrange first to get the stock, you know, transferred to the right places. You know, so everything was down. So basically get rid of the LLC, transfer the stock directly to, you know, the estate, or transfer at least, you know, the stock to the trust, and then have the estate have all the rest of the LLC, have now 100% of the LLC. Whatever you do, reestablish, straighten it out so the stock's now held directly by these things or deemed directly, and then apply for and receive a private letter ruling to get back your S status. All well and good, but also very expensive. You know, be careful. S's are very, 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 very fragile. And you got to be careful doing anything fancy with them. You know, they break very easily. So just keep your eyes open. This structure worked great right till he died. Finally, let's take a look at the IRS release legal advice here right at the end of the week. This is legal advice issued by the IRS's chief counsel, AM 2017-003. It was issued on August the 4th. In fact, it's not even on the IRS website itself directly, doesn't list it. But if you know the backdoor way to get to the links, you'll find it. And it's on our website right now. And I would assume sometime next week, it'll pop up on the IRS's list of these guides from the chief counsel's office. It deals with the payroll tax credit that you're allowed in lieu of the income tax credit for certain small businesses on the research credit. Now, this was established by the Protecting Americans Against Tax Hikes Act of 2015. And it said a qualified small business could elect to claim the credit. Now, the way this works is you finish your tax return. You decide, wait, we're a small business. We're still losing money. I think I'm going to take a portion of this. Now, it can be no more than $250,000 that can be done. But I'm going to take up to $250,000 of my credit. And I'm going to go ahead and apply that against employer FICA. And the law allows me to do that. Now, the question becomes, though, now I'm going to go and I'm starting to try to do payroll after having done this. How do I determine when I should offset and how much I can offset each deposit? Because remember, it's not just enough to know that my 941, I have this credit against the employer FICA. I have to also know how that impacts each individual payroll tax deposit because we have to make them by certain dates and we're penalized for doing an incorrect amount, at least for an incorrect amount that's low, or by doing them late. So the question becomes, how do we apply these against deposits? Well, the memorandum comes out and actually gives us a five-step option for doing this. They're saying what you do is you first calculate the employer's share of Social Security. Now, bottom line, remember, this your first time you can use this credit, you can't use it until the quarter after, the quarter in which you file the return and make the election. So if you file your return today, which would be in August, you're not going to be able to start taking the credit until the fourth quarter because we're in the third quarter. You haven't filed the return. You just filed the return today. Having filed your return in the third quarter and made the election on that return, you can't start using the credit until the fourth quarter. Similarly, if you are if you're basically a taxpayer who's an individual that's claiming the credit, and you're on the October 15th date, and you don't file your return until the 15th, and the credit's on there, then you're going to not be able to take it until January 1st of 2018, because that'll be the first quarter of 18 will be the first quarter after the quarter in which you filed the return. So there is a bit of an incentive to get your return filed early if you have these sorts of losses. What they tell you to do, the first step is you calculate your employer's share of Social Security tax. Now, that's all you can offset. So for each of your deposits, you're going to show on either Form 941, line 16 for monthly depositors or Schedule B for semi-monthly depositors. When you compute the amount due, you reduce the employer FICA only. So we need to know how much employer FICA is in that calculated number before we do the credit. Then we compare the employer FICA for this deposit to the credit. If the credit's greater than or equal to the share of the Social Security tax on wages that's due to the employer's share of the Social Security tax is not reflected on the 941, line 16, or Schedule B. You take that out of your deposit. So you'll just have on there what you withheld from the employee for FICA, Medicare, and for federal income tax withholding, but you won't have on there the employer's share. We'll keep that off of there. If the available credit is less than the Social Security tax, then you reduce and use the credit. As I said, note the amounts of income tax withholding, Medicare tax, and employee Social Security tax on the wages do not get offset. Okay, we still have to use those up. You then take that reduced deposit amount, and that's what you send in on the due date, right? Then you keep going that, basically, if you still have credit remaining, you apply it to the next one and the next one and the next one. You keep doing this in order. And that's how you do it. So remember, you're limited to the employer's share of the Social Security tax. So you don't just stop paying upfront, you know, until you burn the whole thing. You have to make sure you only reduce your deposits by the employer's share of Social Security only. Why? Because that's how Congress wrote the law. Okay. The IRS actually provides a detailed example. So those people who like to walk through examples, they have one that we've reproduced in our materials for this week. So if you download the materials from the website, you'll be able to read those. And secondly, they briefly deal with the special case of if you amend a prior return to claim the credit, which you can only do through December 31st of this year. If you do that, you do not go back and amend 941s. Rather, the date you file the amended return is deemed to be the date that you filed the form, which it is, to elect the credit, which means you're not allowed to claim the credit until the quarter following. So again, the same thing you roll forward. You don't go back and amend 941s. If you do an amended return to claim the credit, that's a transition rule because it was felt that employers may not realize they had this option. And so they thought they'd give them some time. So that's part of how the IRS deals with that on the amended return option. Well, you know, as I say, it is that time of year. We have some stuff going on, and there's still some time before the September rush hits to pick up some courses from your state CPA society. So be sure to go check out the live courses we're going to be doing here over the next few weeks. You know, we have a number here at LaScalzo that are both tax and ANA based. So check your society for those listings. And we hope to see you at one of those courses. This has been the Current Federal Tax Developments for the weeks of August 7th, 2017. Be sure to catch our regular updates on our website at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You also can download a PDF with the articles that have been written for this week on that updates page. If you have any questions or comments, you can email me, edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You can also follow me on Twitter, my address there, @edzollers. Well, we'll see what happens this week. Congress is still out of town and will be for a while. And, you know, things are going to be kind of quiet in August, but we'll see what comes up. And this time next week, hopefully I'll be able to talk to you some more about what's been happening in the area of federal taxes.